Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Fates by C. Gockel, narrated by Barry Krynick. Prologue. Bodhi Patel shifts in his seat, eyes glued to the white door in front of him. The door leads to the familiar halls of the FBI's Department of Anomalous Devices of Unknown Origins, Chicago headquarters. It is locked. They locked him in, like a criminal. Was it Hernandez who turned the bolt, or Steve? He bites his lip. Running his hand through his hair, he looks around the room. He sees thin, dirty brown carpeting and a single fold-out table. The chair he's sitting on creaks. The radiator in the room is ticking, and it's probably too hot. Must be too hot because there is the tiniest prickle of sweat on the back of his neck. Still, he shivers. He turns. There is also a window. Standing up and walking over, he presses his hands to the cold glass and peers through the grime. He's three stories up, facing an alley, but there is a fire escape a few feet to the left. He shakes the hand crank on the sill and feels it give a little. Bodhi swallows. With trembling hands, he pulls out his wallet and flips it open. He has $23. No credit cards. The only ID he has is his badge for HQ. Bodhi Patel, it says below his picture. It's a lie, of course, just like the ID he had been found with. Credit cards, driver's license, social security card were lies. He is not Bodhi Patel. Bodhi Patel was an American citizen who died 26 years ago at the age of 6 months. The only reason a duo calls him Bodhi is because no one knows what else to call him. 6 weeks ago, Loki, so-called god of mischief, chaos, and lies, attacked Chicago, let loose trolls and worms and other nasties, killed thousands of people, displaced hundreds of thousands more, and in a comparatively trivial bit of mischief, wiped Bodhi's memory. All Bodhi knows about the time before Loki comes from Steve, and even that's not much. Apparently, during the chaos, Bodhi had shown up at HQ, given his name as Bodhi Patel, and volunteered to help ferry people out of the city in what later turned out to be a stolen cab. Kind of heroic. According to some people in the office, kind of criminal. Bodhi is probably Indian, but he doesn't have a passport. He shivers. The only reason he wasn't deported was because no one knew where to deport him to. He frowns. He also suspects that Steve had wanted to keep an eye on him. After the accident, his brain had briefly hummed with magical energy. Bodhi flips past the Aduo badge. There is only one piece of authentic identification in his wallet. It is a photo of a dark-skinned man in white shirt sleeves and a woman with slightly fairer skin, in traditional Indian attire, punctuated by a bright orange sari. Both are smiling widely, all their attention on a chubby baby balanced on the man's knee. The baby has a lopsided baby smile and is looking toward the camera, oblivious to the rapt attention but obviously thriving under it. The photo isn't labeled. Bodhi's not sure if he is the child, or even if the couple is his parents, but usually he likes to think that they are. Not so much today. They look so clean, happy, and so good. What would they think of him if they knew what he'd done? He had done it with the best of intentions. The security loophole was glaring and dangerous, even if it was only on the intranet and behind firewalls and logins. After weeks of alerting a duo and nothing being done, he'd proven it. A true criminal would have put the personal details of all of a duo's personnel on the internet. Bodhi just changed all the names to Pig Latin, a silly language he had learned from Claire, Steve's 8-year-old daughter. A true criminal's hands wouldn't tremble at the memory of the confrontation with Steve afterward.
"Do you think this is funny?"
Steve had demanded, hovering above Bodhi's desk. Unable to suppress a smile, Bodhi had replied, "Es ye?" He'd meant to launch into a defense, an explanation of how easy it would be to change the names back, and how now Steve could get funding for more tech support. He'd never gotten the chance.
"Don't you understand we're busy protecting people out there?"
Steve had shouted, pointing to the ruins of LaSalle Street where magical beasties still had a habit of popping up.
"Of course," Bodhi responded. "But this is about protection too, protecting your employees' identities from espionage and blackmail."
Face going a shade darker, Steve snapped,
"You acted unilaterally, without respect for authority. You made this department look bad, and me look bad, at the worst possible time.
Bodhi's skin heated. That was what Steve thought this was about? Trying to make him look bad? His vision had gone red around the edges.
There's no I in the word team, Bodhi, Steve shouted.
Bodhi's lips curled into a snarl.
But there's a you in fuck.
As soon as he had said the words, he regretted them. Steve's face melted into a look of such unmitigated rage that Bodhi shrank in his chair, all his own anger vanishing. I'm sorry was on his lips, but Agent Hernandez had interrupted him.
You do realize you are now a felon.
Bodhi hadn't even realized Hernandez was there. Chin tilted low, eyes glinting in Bodhi's direction, Hernandez said,
You're not an American citizen. Do you know what we could do with you?
Hernandez shook his head, his fists tight at his sides. When Steve had fought to keep Bodhi at a duo, Hernandez had argued he should be deported, or even sent to Guantanamo. Fear twisted so violently in his stomach, Bodhi felt like throwing up.
Get up,
Steve said, jaw tight. Bodhi just barely managed to stand. His legs felt like rubber. Hernandez and Steve had led him to this room. Steve ordered him to sit, then they left and shut the door. He heard the lock click. Bodhi looks down at the picture in his hands. The man, woman, and baby are seated outside. Behind them rises dark green vegetation. The sunlight makes flecks of dust glimmer in the camera's eye and burnishes his parents' shoulders. He imagines this is how the sun is in India, a warm hand on your shoulder all the time. Not like the sun in Chicago in winter. He looks out the window. The sun's position is impossible to know behind the gray of the clouds and smog. He imagines what the smiling woman would say to him.
You had a good thing, with good people, and now you've ruined it.
He wipes his face with his hand. He did have a good thing. Steve looked out for him. He'd gotten him a job, and okay, even if it is just as a glorified receptionist, it's probably better than driving a cab. And set him up with his parents in their enormous graystone out west near Garfield Park. Ruth and Henry Rogers fuss over him like a second son. Now they might deport him, if he's lucky. He looks toward the fire escape. He thinks if he just opens the window, he can make it. And then where? He'd have to leave Chicago. His breath steams the glass. The only frame of reference he has for the country beyond Chicago is the child's map in Steve's boyhood bedroom. In Bodhi's mind, each state is a different bright color, with some landmarks, the Grand Canyon, Mount Rushmore, the Statue of Liberty, drawn in friendly caricature. Beyond Chicago, nothing is real. He'd be no one in nowhere. Bodhi backs away from the window, nearly knocking over the chair. The door clicks, and he drops quickly into the seat. Steve walks into the room, shutting the door behind him with a bang. Not meeting his eyes, Bodhi stammers,
I'm sorry.
Steve doesn't respond until he's sitting down on the table.
You've got to be more than sorry.
Bodhi looks up in alarm. Silhouetted against the cheap fluorescent lights, Steve's skin looks so dark it is almost flat black. His expression is difficult to read. In low, clipped tones, Steve says,
It is not without precedent for the U.S. government to hire talented pranksters with the idea it's better you're with us than against us.
Leaning forward in his chair, Bodhi feels a weight lifting off his chest.
But I can't do that because you're not even a goddamn citizen, Steve says.
Bodhi shrinks back in the seat. Shoving his hands in his pockets, his fingers go to his lighter. He begins to nervously play with the thumb wheel.
What do you want me to do?
Bodhi says. Without a word, Steve holds out a hand with a post-it note. Taking it, Bodhi sees an address and phone number on it.
That is the nearest Marine Corps recruitment center, Steve says. I'll hold off the filing of the charges, somehow. If you prove that you are willing to fight and die for this country, I'll have something to tell the higher-ups.
Bodhi stares at the handwritten scrawl. Die? Steve exhales sharply.
I'll have to think of a way to get you out of the Corps later.
Bodhi looks up. Steve shakes his head.
Your brain is too valuable to lose if you get shot.
Bodhi almost smiles.
But boot camp may teach you some discipline, Steve says.
Bodhi fiddles with the corner of the post-it as Steve says,
Stodgel's already working on the recruiter to deal with the paperwork that will result from your special situation.
Bodhi nods at the mention of the legal counsel's name. He's needed her help a lot. It seems like you need a social security number for just about everything in this country.
All you'll have to do is show up and sign the papers.
Blinking up at Steve, Bodhi nods again, hoping he looks sufficiently grateful. Raising an eyebrow, Steve says,
Just don't wander off into the desert and die during boot camp. Someone always does that.
Bodhi's eyes go wide. Beyond the door, shouts can be heard. Bodhi hears the words troll and new gate. Grumbling, Steve slides from the table and heads to the door. Standing shakily, Bodhi says, Thank you. Steve meets his eyes just before he leaves the room.
My mother would kill me if I let them send you to Gitmo.
Before Bodhi can respond, Steve's gone, but he leaves the door open. Bodhi looks down at the address in his hand. He can picture it. Not the building, but the blue dot on the public transit map he's memorized that marks the blue L line stop nearby. He takes a shallow breath. What choice does he have? Crinkling the paper in his hand, he heads toward the door, the nearest L station, and the recruitment center. He almost makes it. Why the University of Illinois Chicago Medical School hasn't been used for a horror movie set, Steve will never know. The centuries-old Gothic-style building is a hulking dark form on the downtown's southwest horizon. It's the sort of place you'd expect a troll to pop by. Thankfully, the creature was quickly dispatched with goat meat loaded with explosives. Now Steve is standing in a crumbling archway with other Aduo agents and police, fielding questions from the press as cameras flash in his eyes.
Director Rogers, when will the troll sighting stop? Someone asks.
Most likely never. As yet, that is uncertain, Steve says.
Is it certain whether or not you'll be running for mayor? Someone else asks.
There are shouts and cheers through the press corps.
What about president? Someone else shouts. We need you to take on the trolls and worms in D.C.
There are some more cheers, and the adoration feels like electricity under his skin. His mind feels sharp and clear. He feels strong and alive.
Uncertain at this time,
he says, and the crowd gives a collective awe of disappointment, and it just buoys the rush. Fighting to keep from smiling, he wonders if this is what drugs feel like. Someone else raises a hand, but an obnoxious ringtone that Steve certainly didn't download begins to blare over his phone. The moment is over. His jaw ticks. He doesn't have to look at the ID to know who it is. Giving a quick excuse to the press, he turns and walks back through the arch, clicking to accept.
Bodhi, he grinds out. Tell me you are at the recruitment center.
I was almost there, Bodhi says, sounding a little frantic. But then I ran into Amy Lewis.
Steve starts to pace when he hears the name of the girl who had been Loki's, well, something.
What happened?
I was just walking, and I saw her as she fell. I ran over to help. She didn't have her phone, so I couldn't call her grandmother.
Bodhi, what happened? Steve snaps.
We're at the hospital. She's having a miscarriage.
Steve stops mid-stride. He hadn't realized Amy was pregnant. Had she hidden that tidbit of information from him deliberately?
Can you call her grandmother? Says Bodhi.
Steve draws his tongue across his teeth. Amy's grandmother, Beatrice Lewis, is Amy's only real family.
Sure, says Steve, motioning with a hand for Hernandez's attention. What hospital are you at?
Bodhi gives him the hospital name, and Steve says,
I'll be right there.
What about her grandmother? Says Bodhi.
Hanging up right now to call her,
says Steve as he hangs up on Bodhi. He immediately turns to Hernandez.
Get the car started.
With a nod, Hernandez takes off. Steve stares at his phone. The FBI has been waiting for an opportunity like this. He doesn't look for Beatrice's number. Instead, he makes another call. After a few short words with the agent at the end of the line, he heads over to the waiting car, smiling and waving for the press as he goes. A few minutes later, Steve is at the front desk in the ER, holding up his badge.
"I'm here to see Amy Lewis. She was brought in about half an hour ago. She was having a miscarriage."
The nurse behind the counter looks at his badge, and her brow furrows.
"You'll have to wait. The doctors are in with her now."
"This is very important," says Steve.
It's been only 8 weeks since Loki disappeared, and he has no doubt whose baby it is.
"Then maybe you should talk to the father,"
snaps the nurse, pointing down a nondescript hallway.
"He's in the waiting room around the corner."
"The father is here?"
Steve says.
"Yes, he..."
Before she can finish, Steve is bolting down the corridor, nearly colliding with an attendant pushing a wheelchair. As he slides around the corner, his hand falls to the Glock at his hip. He almost pulls it out before he remembers it would be useless. Breathing heavily, he enters the waiting room. Magic detector silent, his eyes scan over the dozen or so people seated there. The only person he recognizes is Bodhi. Striding over to him, Steve says,
"Where is he? Where is Loki?"
Murmurs go up around them. Bodhi glances around.
"I don't know."
"The nurse said the father is here,"
Steve says, grabbing Bodhi by the collar. The lights above them flicker. Meeting his eyes, Bodhi swallows.
"I lied to get into the ambulance."
For the second time in one day, Steve resists the urge to strangle him. Behind him, he hears the sound of rapid footsteps. Bodhi's eyes slide to the side.
"Why are all the agents here?"
Men in black file by them and head down the hallway beyond Bodhi and Steve. The recovery team. Steve watches them go and reminds himself it's not a baby, it's a fetus, and it is already dead. Turning back to Bodhi, he lies.
"Someone told the hospital that the father was here. I had to be prepared."
Bodhi's nose wrinkles up like he might sneeze, and Steve lets go of his collar.
"Where's Beatrice?"
says Bodhi, falling back into his chair and rubbing his nose.
"She's coming,"
Steve lies. Bodhi lets loose a furious sneeze and looks up at Steve with weepy, red, narrowed eyes. Steve feels a twinge of guilt. Putting a hand on Bodhi's shoulder, Steve says,
"Come on. I'll make sure you get to the recruitment center."
Drawing back, Bodhi wraps his hands so tightly around the chair's armrests, his knuckles go several shades paler.
"No, I have to make sure my wife's okay."
He says it loud enough for a passing orderly to hear. The man gives Steve a dirty look. Rolling his eyes, Steve waits for the man to pass and then says,
"Why is this an issue for you?"
He's hoping the question will help Bodhi cut through the clutter of his own internal bullshit. The kid doesn't talk about Lewis, they're not friends, and they've said maybe a dozen words to one another since Bodhi arrived. Bodhi drops his head. His long bangs fall in front of his eyes. Steve expects him to confess something along the lines of, "I'm afraid to join the service." Bodhi shrugs and swallows audibly.
"She and I..."
He shakes his head, looks up, and gives Steve a bitter smile.
"We were both screwed by Loki," says Bodhi.
The kid's eyes are a little unfocused. He sounds so lonely and so lost. With an exasperated sigh, Steve sinks into a seat beside him. Chapter 1. 2 years later. Stepping out of the coffee shop, Amy glances down LaSalle Street. Lifting her head, she gazes up at the former Chicago Board of Trade building, still listing to one side. The windows are dark. Weathered scaffolding protects the sidewalk below from falling rubble. The building has been leaning since the largest earthquake in Chicago's history wrecked its foundations. Coincidentally, at the exact same time, Loki had been dancing in an Aduo interrogation room.
"Such a lovely day," says Amy's grandmother, Beatrice, cheerfully.
Amy blinks at the sky. There is no snow, just a blanket of early morning fog.
It's warm for December, but gloomy. Turning to her grandmother, her lips quirk.
Do you mean the weather, or are you referring to the troll this morning?
Amy's staying with Beatrice until she finds an apartment. This morning, a troll popped up in their neighborhood, and their commute involved an hour-long detour. Periodic trolls, worms, and others visiting Chicago through magical world gates is why the city hasn't been repaired.
"It is just so nice to have you back," Beatrice says, sipping at her coffee.
Her pink flower umbrella swings on her free arm. Amy raises an eyebrow.
"Grandma, you drove down to check on me every weekend while I was at school in Oklahoma."
Beatrice nods and smiles happily.
"And now I can check on you every day while you're in the office, too."
Amy stifles a sigh. Not that she doesn't love her grandmother, but Beatrice has been a little overprotective of late. Amy only managed to keep Beatrice from moving to Oklahoma with her by finding her a job at a duo. Beatrice is fluent in English, Ukrainian, and Russian. Just before Loki attacked Chicago, the city had been visited by dark elves bearing AK-47s. After the attack, Russia, the Ukraine, and Belarus had pushed for the elves to have the rights of the Geneva Convention. The U.S. government even released the captured elves to the Russians. No one knows precisely what the elves are offering the Russians in return for weaponry, but Steve has Beatrice monitoring communications from those countries, looking for clues. Amy appraises Beatrice. She walks with a spring in her step that belies her gray hair and wrinkles. Beatrice has the energy and sharpness of mind of a 20-something. Before Sita and Loki destroyed Chicago, her grandmother had been in a nursing home, unable to remember her own name. And then, something happened. Suffering from wounds inflicted by an ill-advised SWAT team raid, Amy watched the Battle of LaSalle Street from Loki's apartment. When the battle was over, Amy's injuries were healed, and Beatrice was there, her mind and body restored, the outrageous flower umbrella in her hands. Steve and Beatrice posit that Loki healed Amy and Beatrice as a parting gift to Amy. Amy rubs her temple. What Loki did give her as a final parting gift was his memories, and in all his memories, Loki was incapable of healing. Someone else had healed Beatrice and Amy, someone who was a master of biology, someone immensely powerful, and it could only be... Pain flares behind her eyes, and she stops sharply. She winces. Sometimes this happens when she tries to think about that time.
"Are you all right, dear?" says Beatrice.
Amy drops her hand from her temple and finds her grandmother's eyes peering at her from beneath neat gray bangs. Beatrice has a rather fashionable bobbed haircut, and she's wearing a sharp white skirt beneath her fitted black down jacket. She looks more put together than Amy does in jeans, tennis shoes, and casual ponytail. But Steve promised Amy a troll to dissect today. No way is she getting formaldehyde on good clothes.
"I'm fine, Grandma," Amy says, trying to give a reassuring smile.
Why should she care how she and Beatrice got better? The important thing is that they are better.
"Hmm," says Beatrice.
As they resume walking, a shiver runs down Amy's spine. But she shakes her head, and it's as though her apprehension is swept away by invisible hands. Her mood lifts, and she takes a sip of her coffee. It's delicious, and she finds herself smiling. They pass under some scaffolding. Construction has stalled, and there are no workers about. Across the street, a park appears. Off in a corner of the park, Amy notices a woman in garb that looks vaguely priestessy talking to a group of camera-toting tourists. A bus bearing the slogan City of Gods Tours is idling on LaSalle a few feet away. For a minute, Amy gawks, but then she shakes her head. Scientists, the military, and tourism are the only things keeping Chicago afloat.
"This is the place I was telling you about," says Beatrice. "Lovely spot for a coffee break."
The park is pretty. There is a gentle bluff in a wide-open clearing. At the top are semicircular half-walls made of smooth stone, sheltering a seating area. At the center is a statue commemorating the fallen firemen, police officers, and city council members who died defending the city. Following her eyes, Beatrice whispers,
"Some people said it should be a statue of Steve." That man is golden in this town. If he doesn't run for mayor...
She shakes her head. But Amy's eyes have alighted on the four men sitting at the bottom of the statue. There is Steve, Brett, and Bryant, but it's the last person that makes her smile.
Look, Grandma, it's Bodhi Patel. I thought he was in the Marines.
Beatrice taps her chin.
Oh, he was, but he was discharged. Something about a bum spleen.
Let's go sit with them, Amy says as they approach the gentle sloping walkway that leads up to the seating area. I'd like to talk to him.
Hmm, says Beatrice. That boy, she tisks.
Amy bites her lip, a little nervous, as they cross toward the bottom of the stairs. To most people, Loki isn't the person who saved the world from a mind-warping source of infinite magical power bent on world domination. Instead, he is a psychopath who took out a large portion of the city, its defenders, and thousands of civilians. Most of those who know of Amy's association with Loki do not care for her, or even feign respect. She smiles ruefully. Bodhi has as much reason, or more than most people, to hate Amy. But when she'd woken up in an unfamiliar bed after her miscarriage, in a haze of blood loss, the first thing she'd seen was Bodhi's eyes on her. Framed by startlingly long lashes, they were warm, wide, innocent, and earnest.
Hi, he whispered.
And then he'd taken her hand in his. She'd followed the motion with her eyes. Leaning closer, Bodhi whispered,
I lied and told them we were married.
He licked his lips nervously.
I'm sorry, I just had to make sure.
He stammered.
I'm glad you're okay.
And then his face had gone a little pale, and his eyes had opened wider.
I mean, you're not okay, but I'm sorry.
Amy had squeezed his hand. She didn't know Bodhi, really, but she was grateful he was there. She felt lost, empty, and alone. His hand was like an anchor to humanity, and the look of concern on his face was like a balm. If he could care if she lived or died, she could care. And if he could forgive her, then she could forgive herself. She dozed off a few minutes later, but she remembers waking a few more times after that, just briefly, to see him sitting there, hands still in hers, gazing at her intently, Beatrice standing just behind him. Now, as she and Beatrice approach the first of the stairs, she begins to hear the murmur of the men's conversation, and she has a little flutter of panic. What must Bodhi think of her? He's a nice Indian boy, probably from a nice Indian family, even if he can't remember them. All of his compassion in the moment aside, what must he think of her getting knocked up by the guy who wiped his memory? Beatrice and Amy are almost at the top of the stairs when the first of the conversation becomes intelligible.
You did not, says Bryant.
I did too, says Bodhi.
Amy's and Beatrice's heads clear the stairs. Bodhi's back is to them. All of the men's eyes are on him.
I'm telling you I slept with her,
Bodhi shouts, whipping something hot pink from his pocket and hurling it at Bryant. Amy gasps. Brett's eyes meet Amy's and go wide. Bryant shouts as whatever it is lands on his shoulder. Amy blinks. It's a thong. Hopping and shouting, Bryant flicks it back at Bodhi, who snatches it from the air and stuffs it back in his pocket. Brett clears his throat loudly. Beatrice huffs. Rolling his eyes, Steve says,
Hello, Dr. Lewis. Welcome back.
Hi, Amy,
say Brett and Bryant in unison, Bryant still wiping at his shoulder. Bodhi spins around, his eyes wide, mouth open in a startled O. Amy's coffee crashes to the ground at her feet. Bodhi has filled out over the past 2 years, in a good way. He's still a little on the skinny side, but his shoulders are broader. His hair is also neater. His face, with his wide, almost orange-brown eyes, adorable, slightly squished nose, and full lips, is just as open and innocent-looking as she remembered. She feels a blush rising to her cheeks. Innocence? That's a lie, obviously. Maybe it's Amy's imagination, but the sky above her seems to darken. With a shaky exhale, she looks down at the spilled coffee at her feet.
Grandma,
she says.
I think I need to go back to the cafe.
Beside her.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?